Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting, action-packed edition of Something From Nothing, the show where we like to talk live with other game designers about projects we're working on and all sorts of different fun stuff. Thank you for joining us this evening. I am Jason Slinger. I'll be kind of moderating here tonight, and I'm one of the regular panel people on the show. I hold one of the co-hosts of the Building the Game podcast. In addition, we have T.C. Petty, who's normally here with us, and also a game designer, super awesome dude. And we have two special guests tonight that we're really happy about. The first, I will let him introduce himself, is Jamie Stegmeier.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm Jamie Stegmeier, like you said. I am the designer and publisher of two games, Viticulture and Euphoria. My company is called Stonemeyer Games, and we're in St. Louis, Missouri. And actually, I just yesterday, this is my full-time job. So this is what I do.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes.
That's awesome, man. That is awesome. Yeah. Congrats. And next, we have Rob Davio, and he is going to talk to us about his games, too.
Hello, I'm Rob Davio. I'm president of Iron Wall Games. Before that, I was at Hasbro for 14 years, and I designed Trouble Cars 2 and Trivial Pursuit 5. And the Battleship card game and Risk Legacy is what probably everyone knows me for now.
I don't, we start with Trouble Cars 2. Cars 2 game sounds awesome.
Yeah, well.
I mean,
I don't even remember what I did on that one.
Well, thanks for bringing the class level up, Rob, here on the show.
Thank you. You dared me to do a fireside chat, so... here
well,
you go.
Well, it's totally awesome. And then, and I think... this is the first time, too. We have Jamie on, and he is our first designer and publisher, although Jason did the self-publishing thing, too. But, yeah, that's awesome, too. So now we have a first real publisher on to give feedback for all these fledgling designers out there. So, yeah.
All right. Well, let's. Why don't we start with that? What is Jamie? Not to put you on the spot here, but
yeah.
Since TC mentioned it, why don't you give some thoughts? Just some thoughts in general about you know, being a publisher and some advice you'd give to designers in talking to a publisher, and you know, how to deal with a publisher and what a publisher expects. Just from your perspective, of course.
Yeah, are you starting to branch out now and actually getting submissions from people?
Yeah, we are, and that's what I was going to answer Jason's question. That's kind of what we're dipping our toes in those waters right now, looking at other games from other people, and we kind of started that. We had a little contest for Viticulture about 3 months ago. Where we invited other designers to submit an expansion to Viticulture, and we made it. I think it was a $2,000 contest where the winner would take $2,000. So that was our first effort to kind of bring in other designers. And now we have open submissions. So we're starting to get some. Most of them have come from contacts that we've made personally in the industry so far. TC, I guess you how did your process go when you submitted games to Dice Hate Me? Did you meet them personally first, or did you submit out of the blue?
Yeah, because it was kind of like how you're talking about, where you shifted from, well, we're just going to do this kind of like publishing thing.
Right.
Whenever I first talked to Chris, he wasn't even a publisher at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of, you know, we're at Origins. I meet them through some mutual friends, and then. Suddenly we're playing the game, and when afterwards, that's when the conversation started to happen. They were going to work on Carnival, and they wanted to do something bigger, so they were like, Viva Java, let's do this. Right. And I was very happy, but at the time, I mean, if you think about it, and probably in the same situation you are, they were brand new, so it was really, really, I went to pretty much all my friends to ask, is this a good idea? Am I just being stupid?
Right.
Because going with someone who hasn't even published a game yet. But I can't be happier. I mean, I think it worked out. Like, most people probably look back at it and go, oh, well, why wouldn't you do it? But I think it worked out fantastically. So, you know, Took a chance. That's all I did. You know, and I think you're in the same boat, but you did it. You did it phenomenally. I mean, just basically giving people what they want is a big talent. And I mean, if you can do that, especially with two Kickstarters, then you got it. So, I mean, yeah, it's awesome to hear that you can actually go full time with it. So,
yeah, I think I'm very fortunate in that we've been able to do that. And part of it is contingent upon retail sales after Kickstarter, too. We spend almost all the Kickstarter money on the games, trying to make them as awesome as possible. So, Rob, are you thinking about going the Kickstarter route, or is that up in the air right now?
It's a little up in the air right now for Seafall. It's one of the two options I'm looking at for funding, but there's some other stuff that might be happening that I might do instead. And as much as I like Kickstarter, it scares the hell out of me. Uh-huh. Right? And I know it would take a lot of my time to do, and if I can find an alternate route where I could be focusing on the design of my next game rather than managing Kickstarter, I might go that way. But I'll know more probably next month.
I'll tell you, from working on Euphoria, when I ran the Kickstarter for about a month and a half before Euphoria, all I did was set up the Kickstarter. And then all I did for the month during Kickstarter was run the Kickstarter. And then the month after, all I did was clean up the Kickstarter and get all the production files set up and whatnot. And I remember in maybe mid-July, I sat down and I didn't have to do one night. I didn't have anything to do on Kickstarter. And I was like, oh, wow, I can finally design something, like anything. And it was so refreshing to be able to do that after not having that for 2-3 months.
Yeah, that's my that's not a concern, but that's, you know, uh-huh. I have to plan for it.
Yeah.
I have to think, if I'm going to take 3 months to be doing a Kickstarter, how does that affect my shipping dates, my ability to design, to do work for clients, so on and so forth. So I'm just looking at those different factors right now.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, before we jump off the subject, I know that Seth on Seth Jaffe on Twitter asked for you to explain your thoughts on international shipping and how to maybe give other publishers that are trying this restate what maybe you've done in other blog posts about how international shipping works and maybe how to get that down so that people can pledge from other countries.
Right. I won't go into too much detail because I've written like a 10-page essay on the Stillmire Games website on how to do it. But the basic crux of it is that we use Amazon Fulfillment. Amazon has fulfillment centers at several key countries around the world where a lot of backers come from. So we have one, there's one in Canada, there are many in the US, and there are several in the EU as well. So instead of shipping games, I think the old method was to ship games from, say, China to the US, and then ship them, however, USPS, UPS, FedEx, around the world. We ship our games directly to these Amazon fulfillment centers. And by doing that, not only do we keep our costs down and backer costs down, but we also, because we're shipping from like within the EU and within Canada, we keep the value-added tax down for backers. So that's something I don't even discuss that all that much, but that's one of those things that we do with the backers in mind, where they don't have to pay that tax anymore because we pay it when the games enter the country. It is a fair amount of added work to set it up in the first place, but once you have your Amazon fulfillment seller account set up around the world, it's pretty easy from there to do it. Now, I do say that, and I'm right in the midst of international shipping right now. And the only problems we've had haven't been with Amazon. It's been with secondary shipping companies, the companies that receive the games. Right now, the problem is there's a company in Germany that received our games and kind of just held on to them for a few weeks and didn't do anything with them. So our EU backers have kind of suffered through that. We're not late yet, but it's kind of sucked that the games have been sitting there. So you have a little less control, I guess, of individual game shipping when you use this method. But in the end, I think it's best. It works out well for everyone.
Yeah, a little less of the personal touch, but at least it seems like it's flowing well.
Right. At this point. Right.
Sweet.
Plus, I think so many people trust Amazon, right? So when you stay using Amazon Fulfillment, that just sounds really legit.
Right.
I mean, to be honest. Hey, and one thing I just want to interrupt just real quick here. Chevy Dodd hopped on, so I just want to give a quick hey to Chevy Dodd, one of our regular panelists.
Hey, everybody. Sorry I was late. I was en route to house.
The stars or whatever behind you, those Christmas decorations, you kind of look like you're in some sort of disco
those are my those are my Christmas lights in my front window. I'm kind of in a I'm in a weird position tonight because my dining room table is taken over by a woodworking project. So
I see.
I'm kind of up against the window. So everybody does woodworking projects at their dining room table, right?
I usually have prototypes on mine, so I can't do my woodworking projects.
I've got like a big blue tarp in here because I was painting in here, so I've got like this big blue tarp, and you know, it's kind of a mess.
I really wish that's where your computer had been set up. That would have been awesome. You know what it is, actually, Chevy? It actually kind of looks like you're in like a picture from like the 1990s for like someone's high school. Laser design that would be behind. It's kind of
I'll angle
like
the camera up just a little bit for you. There you go.
Even better. Nice.
Is that even better? Yeah. If I put my head, about right here, I fill that hole. There we go.
There we go.
I'll just sit like this for the rest of the night.
It's a little early Doctor Who.
I don't know. I think Rob wins because Rob tweeted that he was going to sit in front of a fireplace tonight, and you know, and we were like, yeah, whatever. No, he actually pulled it off. So
Rob the fire's dying though. Sorry. Now it's just more of a glowy sort of thing.
Yeah.
We were hoping he would just say pretentious things all night long too.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I could do that. I could put an affected accent and hold a martini glass if that will help. But
You're prepared. I like it. Are there olives in that glass?
No, it's just it's a deliberately cracked glass, like it's got, you know, crackle in there.
Nice.
Oh. So cute.
All right.
So
where were we? Get back on track here. we have another question for Jamie from Seth, but I think that it was answered, so I just want to make sure that it was... Oh, I think we just lost Jamie. Well, we're not going to ask that question to Jamie, but... Because we just lost him.
Someone asked a question about me.
He's back. Look, he's back. Well, hey, so Rob, what have you been working on then? Let's talk about that.
My big thing that I'm working on right now is the spiritual successor to Risk Legacy, which is called Seafall. And that is taking up most of my time and sanity trying to figure out how to do that. I'm at the point where it's pretty good, but where it's not good, it's really bad, right? And so, you know, I've tried a lot of different things, so I'm excited tonight to talk about all of my failures and dead ends that I've hit on that. I also spend a lot of my time doing consulting work for mass market board companies, you know, companies like Hasbro. I left that company because they moved my job, and so I couldn't follow it, so I still do a lot of work for them. And then I get some other stuff going on that I can't quite get into yet because I'm working with partners or with publishers and we haven't gone public or gotten formalized yet. So I'm overly busy.
That's awesome. Well, I'm most interested in, even though it sounds bad, I'm most interested in the failure part because I want to learn how to avoid. From people who are uninterested or don't know what the legacy thing is.
Yeah.
Why don't you give a real quick overview of what you think a legacy game is? So the stock answer.
The stock answer is a legacy game that where the actions, some of the actions in one game carry over to future games. So some of the things you do in game one affect game two, which affect game three. So everyone buys the same game, but after you play it 15 times, it basically has shaped to be a game that reflects the history of your gaming group.
That's right. And deals with permanence, I guess.
Too. And it's in a permanent way.
Permanent way, yes.
And
which I think is the key.
That is the key. So you make permanent changes. You write on the board, you rip up cards, you put stickers down. It's a one-way trip.
And that's awesome. And I think that's brand new, or at least the mindset behind it is brand new, because people don't do it too much, if at all.
Yeah, I think it is. I haven't been able to find something that does it exactly like this, although it's really just, it's kind of like a board game version of a role-playing game, right? You do it all the time in a role-playing game. Oh, I got a sword. You write it down. But it's usually in pencil, and then you erase it later. And you know.
Yeah, and you can go back.
You can go back.
Or you can make a dry erase.
Right.
What's the so you were saying failures? Now I'm more interested in wondering, as a game designer who might go down this path at some point. What's the most epic failure you've made so far that you would say definitely don't go down that path if you're trying to do a legacy game? I know you're.
Yeah.
You talk about. Yeah.
I've done one and a half of them. So. The first one was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and this one is trying to figure out what I did right in the last one. So I'm still learning myself. But the big thing in Seafall that I would not do is make too much carry from one game to the next. Seafall is an empire-building game, so you've got ships, and you've got this empire you're building, and money, and goods, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on, and I made a whole bunch of that carry through from game to game, so the empires would grow. Which meant that far too many people spent their time growing their empire and would say, I don't care if I win three or four games. I'm going to win the last six. So the idea of winning a game went away. It entirely became one long game that you played in discrete chunks rather than, I won this game, I get a reward. And you know, you want to keep the focus on winning the game, not the connective stuff. That has to be sort of the nice remainder after someone won, rather than the main goal.
So is it hard to balance that?
Yes.
I mean, because it doesn't seem like... It seems like... Now, in Seafall, is there supposed to be an overall winner? Because it kind of feels like it would be hard to do that. I was writing down some things about legacy games. I'm like looking like, if there's an overall winner, it kind of has to almost be a game that doesn't matter. Because it like Risk can work like that because you could be like, oh, well... You know, I'm the overall winner, but it really doesn't matter because you had the shared experience. But if you're trying to win each game, you want each game to be the thing. But
well, I want people to win each game because the advantage of winning a game has to be better than not winning the game but working a long strategy. And that's the balance thing. I want it to be, I won, so I get to do something to this game that will help me a little bit more then it helps everyone else, so that you want to win, so that you can get these same advantages. And I don't want the path to victory to be like, I don't care if I win, I'm going to make this awesome navy, this fleet, that is just going to destroy you. It's going to take me a couple games, but then I'm going to come out and I'm going to be really powerful. That can't be a viable strategy because everyone was doing that, and it was really bad.
Rob, I've been curious. I've been listening to your podcast, and I don't know if I've heard you talk about what the winner of each individual game gets to do for the next game. Like the winners, in Risk Legacy, I know that the winner got to choose a slightly better thing to happen to the game. What happens in Risk Legacy or in Seafall?
Well, it's a bit in flux right now because one of the things that I play tested on Wednesday with a group, and you would think I would have had this down by now, but I'm not entirely happy with the win conditions. Like what you do to win the game. And I've gone through a couple different systems in there. And the one I have now works well, but you're kind of playing the math, which is not something I like in a game. You know, it's kind of like I attacked your ship and got this level of dice roll. And it's like, I don't want you to win because you got a 35. I want you to win because you destroyed someone's armada, right? It's the same thing, but I want a way to record it and tabulate it where you're thinking of the historical event, not the math behind it. So it's a little bit up in the air right now. I had an idea Thursday, and I love the idea, and I spent much of Friday getting mad that I can't figure out how to make it work, which is almost the victory conditions would be a timeline like you'd see in a history book. And when you do something really monumental, like found a city out on an island and become a governor, you actually mark on the timeline, this city was founded in, you know, 1561, and you get victory points. And so you can look back after 15 games and actually see a couple hundred-year timeline of this civilization and when cities were built and when empires fell and when things happened. So now I have my story, but I can't figure out the math, and I have the system that's in there now, which is math, but it doesn't tell a good story, and I got to reconcile those two things together, which isn't exactly the question you ask about the benefits, but those are a little up in the air as a result.
Sure.
Do you have a thought on like multiple end conditions for games? I think we talked through email a little bit, but I I'd written down some ideas about how I thought, like, how could you go from a game like Risk, which is a little bit easier to intro to somebody,
yeah.
And get to a meatier game, but still keep the legacy thing, and then also keep each game interesting.
Yeah.
Have you considered, like, multiple end conditions? Like, if I get to a certain amount of points, or if I found a certain amount of cities,
yeah.
Or is it all based on the victory point total?
So right now I kind of did it as an abstraction, not unlike Risk Legacy, which essentially has four victory points. They're just called red stars. And those can be achieved a number of different ways. You can take over headquarters, you can use cards to buy them, and then in later games, and this is not a spoiler, there are missions, and then there are, spoiler, other ways to do it. So there are multiple paths to the same thing, which is just get 4 points. So trying to do the same thing here, which is right now get 8 points, but there's sort of four main categories within the game. There's fighting, exploring, building, and trading. So depending on which path you're taking, you could be trading and getting a lot of money and a lot of goods and sort of cornering the market and setting yourself up as a mercantile empire while someone else was trying to become sort of the scourge of the sea and taking over things and raiding with military. And I want both of them to be viable options. So I do have multiple paths, but I was trying to have a easy to remember victory. It's like get 8 glory. It's just that the paths right now, it just looks like, it honestly looks like you're playing on a spreadsheet. And I don't like that thematically. So I'm a bit in a hole right now. And I was talking about it with my co-publisher, Colby from Plaid Hat Games. And he was like, you got something that works, so you can always fall back to it, but this is a time to spend the weekend going crazy trying to think of something else. And I'm trying. It'll just take longer than the weekend. Unless anyone here has any ideas which would help me out.
A couple of quick questions for you, Rob. From Robin Lee's, and maybe you feel like you've already answered this, but just to make sure, what's the hardest aspect of designing a legacy game compared to a regular game? My guess would be you're saying balance, because there's so much more to balance over the, but I could be wrong.
It's balance, but in a different way. It's that you want game one, at least I do, is like almost to be like first level characters. Like you can't do much, and the game is going to grow. You're going to get more powers. More things are going to be on the board. So by the time you're in game 15, you will have powered up. You'll be able to do much more than you would be able to do in game one. So the challenges of what you do to win also have to grow. So when I'm designing game one, I'm thinking, okay, what pieces do I grow so that in game 10 it's still a challenge? So there's that balance. Like, you explore islands in here, and some of the islands you might find or on the board right at the beginning have these numbers that are really high that you don't have the stats to discover them. You just can't do it. So I want that to be enticing, like, oh, someday we'll explore there, and then make sure that they actually get there at the right pace, where in my head I say, yeah, around game 7, 8, or 9, I'd like them to have the capability to explore this, and then you play it, and they can do it in game 3. So you change the numbers, and then they can't do it till game 14. And there's about 5 dozen of those sorts of balancing scope creep things that I'm trying to keep in sync. Like, the game's working. The pieces that I'm playing now, I'm really enjoying. But we're on, with my current version I'm playing, we just finished 4 games. And in terms of things being unlocked and where we are on power and level, it's where I want it to be on game 9. So it's going twice as fast. So I have to figure out, like, how do I slow it down? Because you don't have enough time to integrate all the new things you find before a new thing happens. And so you spend your whole time kind of choking on the newness, and you don't really, you know, what I want in the game is you play it, you find something new, you go, that's cool, and you spend a game or 2 or 3 playing around with it, and just when you think you've got a handle on it, I give you something new. And it's just all, it's like a fire hose right now of new stuff.
Good, cool, good answer. And then the second one is, and you're talking about you want to make the reward winning, for winning a game to be big, the flying sheep's question was, if you do that, if the reward for winning is too extreme, does that lead to a rich get richer problem?
Yes.
In the game?
That's the other edge that I want to avoid. To some extent, the other players will gang up on the perceived leader, and a little bit of that is fine, because if you think even within a regular game, if you're playing a 4-player game and someone got ahead, the other 3 might you know, not trade with them, or whatever the game is, you know, would work to try to get the leader rather than each other. And so a little bit of that policing is fine, but I can't rely on that being the only policing that's there. So the rewards have to benefit the winner a little bit more, or preferably shape the world in such a way that the winner wants it to be shaped, but everyone can play in it. Like, if someone's really into fighting, they might try to make it a little bit more of a combat-based world, but everyone gets those benefits. So you're almost like shaping the game to your play style. But yeah, it's a little bit maddening right now trying to find the sweet spot between those.
Have you considered collective? Again, this is no spoiler for me, but like, I haven't gone through Risk Legacy, so I don't know all the little secrets, collective loser decisions. Have you ever had like vote by committee for any of these changes that occur during the course of the game?
No, it's an interesting idea, like that the losers form a coalition.
Yeah, that they all automatically at the end, you know, whether or not... I was even thinking, like, you know, sometimes the original was at the end of every game. Well, you know, it's like you have the option now of, like, with islands and stuff that you're exploring, you would actively flip over something and immediately have to open an envelope in the middle of a game. Now, I mean, and I don't know if you've explored that, but that seems like an interesting, cool aspect of this island building thing, too.
Yeah, so. You do open stuff in the middle of the game now if you're exploring an island and you find something. There's a couple things that you go, oh, this is brand new, right? We've dug into the heart of this island. We found something, and now we get to open this and see what it does.
Yeah. But like the emerges and everybody has to vote on something, or
no, that part I haven't done yet.
Okay. So, I mean, that could help with something, especially with the winner advantage, but the losers get something. Maybe they can build up a certain side strategy.
Yeah, there's something kind of like that in Seafall right now, which is the winner gets their advantage, and then all the losers look at the current state of their empire. Who has the most gold? Who has the most cannons? Who has the most advisors, which are cards? And they get a little bonus going into the next game, depending on if they have the most of any of these, and the winner is ineligible for these rewards. So they get one big permanent change, but all of the losers get a little temporary bump to start the next game. So one person's making a macro change, and then the other 2 to 4 people get these little micro changes that are temporary, but they start the next game with a little bit of a leg up, hopefully.
Yeah.
You know.
Did anybody... So working with, like, the idea of... I don't want to be the only one asking questions, but we're with the only with Legacy. I'm just so interested in like the Legacy aspect because it seems like it's such a difficult balance. Have you run into something? I guess that's the thing I'm trying to avoid. If I were to work on something like this, was even having this idea this week. I was gonna think of a Legacy game and maybe like pitch it here, but really, okay. It was just pretty much an idea of, like, in 15 minutes, I want to play a game that's like a Legacy game where I rip things up and I destroy stuff. But I do that over the course of 20 games and create some sort of piece of abstract art. What's something that is just, I don't know, an avenue not good to go in for these things? There's more than one? I don't know specific about it, but...
Like, what avenue is not good for a Legacy game?
Yeah, like, are there any things that you did during a playtest that you just had to almost stop the playtest in the middle because it just wasn't working?
Yeah, most stuff. I'm trying to think of...
I know I'm not being specific.
No, yeah, random... The first thing I did, random permanent change, very bad. What I try to do is, as much as possible... Anything permanent that happens to a game was a player choice. They may not understand the full ramifications of that choice, but they did it. Right? You don't want it to be like, oh, and I had this idea with Risk Legacy at the beginning, oh, you rolled 3 sixes, you just blew up India. And you're kind of like, oh, well, that was the first roll of the game. Or, you know, like, if you're going to ask someone to permanently change their game, they have to be the ones to change it, not the game just is changing and they're watching it change. Well, That's my understanding. Someone may be able to design a great game that does that. I have only a few more answers than anyone else at this because it was such a bizarre idea that I've only done, like I said, like 1.5 times.
That makes sense. Yeah. I guess Flying Sheep asks, have you played this? We didn't play this at all, Legacies.
No, I'm aware of it, but I have not played it. And it's not that I don't want to. I saw that it existed, but I haven't seen the game since then.
I haven't heard anything.
You know what's interesting about Seafall is I was looking at this today. I think it's Jamie's game, the wine game. I'm drawing a blank on the name now.
Viticulture.
Viticulture. In Seafall, you have a spring, summer, fall, winter, like round type thing, and then you like repeat it, and it's not worker placement, it's card playing, but it's the same idea. And you may have solved an idea that I'm struggling with too, which is like the whole first player notion, like mm-hmm. the empire that goes first. Right now I have them going first for a whole year, spring, summer, fall, winter, and there are some advantages there, and I've tried a whole bunch of things about how the turn order shifts around. And all of them were the same thing I think you said in your... It was either in your blog or the Board Game Geek write-up, how it can be fussy to take turn order from people.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious about what you did in Viticulture. I kind of read it, but I haven't played it. Could you just tell me a little bit more about how you mitigate that? Because it's something I'm struggling with.
Sure. I'll tell you what we did. I won't say that it's the best solution, but I can describe what we did. Basically, we took... are you familiar with Fresco? The game Fresco?
Yeah.
So Fresco has like a wake-up track, and we basically took that concept from Fresco and put it in Viticulture, except in Fresco, if you wake up really early, I think things are more expensive. Like, there are some penalties for waking up too early. The only penalty in Viticulture, if you wake up too early, is that you don't get as good of stuff as if you had woken up later. And so that was kind of the first solution, now this wake-up track. But the rule in the game is that the player in the first position on the wake up track still that player goes first every season, so that doesn't shift around.
Okay.
The other thing that we did, and this was actually my business partner's idea, at the end of every year, the first player token, I guess. Okay, so at the beginning of the year, when you're choosing wake up order, you choose it clockwise. But at the end of the year, the first player token passes counterclockwise.
Okay.
And what we realized early on in testing is, like, in a larger game, a 5 or 6 player game, if you're choosing your wake-up order clockwise and you're passing that token clockwise, if you just get unlucky and you're not the first player the first year, you're going to feel left out of the options that you want for a long time, because it'll take forever to get around to you. But if you pass it counterclockwise, then even though you're picking last the first year, you're picking first the second year. So it ends up averaging out a lot better. It's not. I don't think the combination of those two are the ideal solution for a game with seasons, but it's worked pretty well.
Okay.
Do any of you other guys have suggestions about games with, I guess, phases or seasons like that in terms of turn order?
No.
I'm trying to think of how
games are always. Yeah, like I don't. My games are usually like cyclical or something. I did the game one time where it was the turn order was like if you attacked another player, then it became that player's turn, and so you could have these interesting little moments where like two players go back and forth at each other for a while. But really, if you did that, the game was limited because it was a card play game, so that eventually you'd have to attack somebody else because you weren't really gaining any ground just by going at one person. But that way, there was no fixed turn order; it was just kind of up to the players to decide. But I would prefer in the games that I play, I like it when there's maybe like a player action I can take that influences the turn order, as opposed to just having some static round, thing. Mm-hmm. If we're going to jostle turn order up, I'd like it for the players to kind of be involved in that decision somehow.
Yeah. And that's, I had something in Seafall earlier on where players could really choose their turn order and they could use some of their actions to pick turn orders, and it was a whole separate system and another thing to do. And I have too much going on in this game, right? Anyway, so I just took it out and just like it just passes clockwise, and I don't know if it was the final solution, but it enabled me to stabilize that to test the rest of the stuff. But now that I'm kind of going around with the wind condition and some other things, I'm opening it up again, but I just don't want to do what I was trying to do last summer, because I know that wasn't working, and it was just like, oh, I have to remember that as well. And so I was just looking, and I was intrigued today when I was reading about your solution for viticulture.
Well, one other thing that I didn't think about when I was first answering that is that in viticulture, in each of the seasons, each of the actions has a bonus if you were the first to choose that action. And so the first player to go in the first season, they'll get the action that they want, and they'll get that bonus. But the other players, they all have that positive feedback of also being able to choose another action and being the first player to choose that bonus.
Okay.
So I don't know if there's any equivalent to that in Seafall.
I got to think it through, but there's like four different suits, like I was saying, fighting and trading and things like that. So it might be if you're the first one to do one of those actions in a season, you might get the bonus. I don't know if that's a cool other thing to think about or an annoying extra thing to think about.
Right.
So I would have to think about it more and play it out.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I mean, that is a bit of a derivative from like the standard Puerto Rico, you know, the first player gets the bonus and that's it.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea of the first person to take the action. That's pretty slick.
Yeah. I like positive feedback in games. I like people to feel happy every time they make a choice, or most of the time.
Yeah.
I was actually working on a game called Club Zen, which I've talked about here before, but it's like a worker placement game where you're relaxing at a resort. And I wanted to kind of make the mechanics work in a relaxing way. So one of the things I always hate about worker placement games is the first player advantage. You, person who goes first, they get the pick of the board, and they pretty much exclude other people from what they want to do. And in Club Zen, the way that I finally got it to the point where I was like, there is pretty much no first player advantage, but there's reasons to go first and reasons to go last, was that I made it so that most all the spaces on the board are available to everyone no matter what. The issue is if you go first, you get to go to that spot, and there are certain areas where that is good and you're guaranteed to be in there and first and get a first selection of something when that action is activated. But most of the spots on the board, everybody can go to together. So if you're going last, you actually get a bonus, or not going last, if you're going at any point, you get a bonus for going to the same spot with someone else. So there's an incentive to go to the same spot with people. So you want to go to the same spot. So the person in last place gets the pick of where they want to go to be with somebody else to get the bonus and take the action. So it kind of evens that out. Do I take the first action, guarantee I get a spot on where I want, or do I take the last action and guarantee that I can get the bonus, and then I also have a pick choice of maybe three actions that now I can choose between and also get an extra bonus for doing it.
That's a cool idea.
I don't know if that like worked for Seafall, honestly, but what Jamie was saying, everybody loves the positive reinforcement. Anything that you can do to avoid negative points in a game is a huge positive. It just makes the game more fun, even if it's completely blatantly masked as a negative to get nothing. As long as you just chose to get nothing, as opposed to getting like minus 1 point, it's like,
oh yeah, I don't really.
Times better.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do in Seafall that will give you like send you backwards. There is some stuff where other people can send you backwards, possibly. You know, if you're about to win, I do want the ability to other people to try to prevent it, not say, oh, nothing we can do. Let's just play it out, right?
Yeah. But,
Rob, do you have any mechanics in Seafall that let you spend those 8 points? Do you use them as currency?
Not right now, because they're kind of hard to get.
Yeah.
Or they want them to be hard to get. And they're usually sort of monumental, like I founded a city on this island, or I discovered a new island, or I sunk your fleet. Right? They feel big, so I wouldn't want them to just disappear when you get them. But
right.
Well, that's
but I also, just because I haven't thought of it either.
That's interesting too, because Jamie, your game Euphoria, I mean, it's and I was I definitely not a comparison that I want to make, but just as far as point totals, it's got that Settlers of Catan or Alien Frontiers feel, where it it is only 10 points, or and like a Seafall is like 8 points.
Right.
That restriction there causes a bit of kill the leader aspect in these mm-hmm. games. Do you guys find that there's a gang up on the leader issue in either of those two games, and how did you kind of, maybe Jamie first, since you have it there, how did you deal with kind of that idea that there's only a few amount of points and we're kind of racing, but I want to make sure that I get there before someone else? How do you get rid of the bash the leader blatantly problem, I guess?
Well, that's a really good question, because I don't know if we actually did address it well enough. That's probably my only qualm about the way Euphoria turned out, is that if you are maybe a turn or two away from winning, everyone can see it, and there's not a lot they can do about it. In earlier versions of the game, we did have ways that, like if I placed 9 of my stars on the board, there were ways that other players could remove some of those stars, and it really just didn't work. Kind of like what Rob said, when you have that few points, every point doesn't really feel like a point anymore. It feels like one step closer to victory, and if you take that away, suddenly you feel like you're going backwards. So that solution didn't work, but I in hindsight, I am looking at the Euphoria design and thinking there might have been a more elegant way to stop a leader, or at least stall a leader a little bit, perhaps sacrificing yourself in the short term as well, just to prolong the game a few extra turns. But right now there really isn't that in the game. But although I guess the only thing that makes me feel okay with that is that in Euphoria you take, like, the turns are really fast and you take a lot of them in the game. Usually you end up taking around 50 or 60 turns. So if it comes down to one or two turns, players usually don't feel bad about that, because they're like, oh, okay, that's, like, it's okay that they're going to win. They deserve to get to that point.
Yeah, if you're at 60 turns and it's the last two, it's such a small part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Rob. Seth Jaffe's mentioned like 2 or 3 times now on Twitter about checking out how Francis Drake handles turn order. Basically, players either, you know, pass turns this phase, or maybe they bid for turn order for the next phase. So
I'll go take a look at it.
He's really pushing for you to go check out Francis Drake.
Okay. And yeah, it's interesting. I'm overly cautious about not checking out other games that are in the same general theme as the one I'm doing.
Sure.
Yeah. I think a little too much so. I think it's a type of industry, if I look at that and go, oh yeah, that could work, and then I change it and make it my own. It's a small part. No one's going to mind, but I kind of have this, everything has to be brand new and my own thing. Like, I bought Merchants and Marauders and stole the ships out for my prototype and then put the lid back on. And I'll love the game, but I like kind of opened it and I was just glancing through it and I'm like, oh, there's some cool stuff in here. Damn it, I think they're doing it better than I am, you know, and I didn't want to just rip it off wholesale. So
I'm Rob Davio. I've designed 60 games. What do I need this game for?
Yeah. Now, a lot of the games I've done have been, you know, like, 10 or 15 Trivial Pursuit games where I was an editor. But technically, I designed them, although it was just changing the cards in the box.
So humble.
Yeah.
I promise you, everybody who watches this show wishes they could change the cards in the box of Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah, well, you know.
We all dream of that job, honestly.
Yeah, you know. It turns out that I do, things come out of my head from being an editor on Trivial Pursuit, where I was like, how do I know that? Like yesterday, I was like, I think I'm going to make pork pot stickers for dinner, or as they're called, shumai. And I don't eat in Chinese restaurants that often, and people are like, is that what they're called? I'm like, I don't know, and I look on my phone, I'm like, yeah, how did I know that? I'm like, oh, Trivial Pursuit games, working on those. Like, it just all went in and flies out at random times. That's my heritage now.
Well, speaking of, I mean, I think Seth always gives good recommendations, honestly. Oh, so if anybody's working on a game, ask Seth Jaffe what game has already existed that he's played at least 10 times, or I don't know if he's played it 10 times, but he's already played it. He knows what your game needs. So I'm working on a game that uses like the old school Pharaoh mechanic, which is like old gambling game for like cowboys and stuff, and I wanted to apply that to a cowboy town, like a ghost town. So the idea is you're placing your workers, but they're actually just like betting chips almost that you're placing on different locations to get actions as the pharaoh cards come out and activate different things around the board. But since it was about mining, he recommended Sutter's Mill, which is really, really close to what I was working on, and it gave me a lot of good information to go on, because they were thinking of a lot of the same things I was, and I could take a lot of the stuff that I thought felt was negative and then just, you know, make it my own. So yeah, hoping that it all comes together and works, but it's tough. So
well, I'm gonna check it out right after we get off this podcast, or as much as I can get from the internet.
That's right. Jamie, yeah. I don't want to out you here, but you were talking to me beforehand about the fact that you were thinking of that you were happy that Rob was on because you were thinking about moving in a legacy style direction with one of your games. Do you feel comfortable talking about maybe what you were thinking as far as that? I mean, you don't have to go into specifics about the game or itself, but what were you looking for as far as information?
Right. And actually, to give Rob credit, I emailed Rob a few weeks ago and I said, you know, Rob, I'm thinking about turning one of our games into a legacy game. Are you open to other people using that term, legacy? And Rob is really gracious about it. I appreciate that, Rob.
No problem. I mean, I'm happy if other people try to do it. Right now, I'm doing it because I just started my own company and people know me for it, so I'll do a few more until they tell me to stop doing it. But go right ahead.
Well, and what we discovered since then, so basically, I guess, TC, you asked the question to Rob and I before we came on the show, if we've encountered any problems with game design, especially in terms of legacy games. And what I experienced recently was that legacy became a solution for a game that wasn't a legacy game. I've been working on this Tuscany expansion pack, really, to Viticulture. And I basically right now I have 16 expansions to Viticulture, some small, some large. And as I kept adding these expansions, more and more expansions, I realized that to open a box, even if you're very familiar with Viticulture, you open this box of Tuscany and you're faced suddenly out of the box with 16 expansions, you're just going to be so overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And so I was talking with my design partner about it, and we were kind of just brainstorming ideas for what to do about that. Like, should we just cut it down to a few expansions in a box? I didn't really like that. Like, I don't want to draw it out and make it a game where I sell 16 different expansions, because some of them are pretty small. And we realized that one of the brilliant things about Risk Legacy is that you start out with a game that you already know, and you unlock all these packs one by one. It kind of unravels this world in a way that you can easily comprehend it. Rob, that might be what I think is the most brilliant part about Risk Legacy, among many brilliant parts. But I love how the game unravels. And so what we've done with Tuscany is we've made it, and I actually don't think, Rob, I don't think we're going to use the legacy term. We're going to use a term called tiered or terraced.
Yeah.
Because in vineyards, that's like a vineyard viticulture term, a tiered field or a terraced field. So when you open the box to Tuscany, on the top layer will be maybe one or two expansions. And you'll play those, the game will recommend that you play those a few times, and then you'll open up the next tier and then open up a new pack or two. So it won't exactly follow the Risk Legacy method of the players determining when the pack's opened, but it will stagger it so that it's not as daunting to players when they open that box.
Yeah. That's interesting. I kind of wonder about that. If people, because I know I used to fall victim to this myself, where you open up and says, we recommend you play these two before moving on. And you go, I'm an awesome game player. You rip everything open. You're like, I'm playing everything at once. Right. And then you confuse yourself, right? You do what the designer told you not to do. And then you get all confused. So I'm just wondering, are you designing the physical box so that the other ones are underneath and harder to get to and you can't see them, like something that makes them less tempting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there will be actual cardboard layers in the box.
Great.
Now, I think, Jamie, what you were saying was kind of something I was thinking about when preparing here, and which sometimes I do. The legacy games now, it seems like it seems to me, after looking at this, that it's easier to make a legacy game if you don't think about making a legacy game at first. You just make the game, and you don't think about the fact that it's going to be made into a legacy-style thing, because once you start thinking about that, you get into the idea that it has to be a certain way. But if you think about it as a self-contained game that you could play over and over and over again just by itself, and then you simplify it as much as possible, you can add those complications as the game goes on. I don't know if you ran into that, Rob, or just thinking about it that way. But
That's what I should have done with Seafall. I should have just made this awesome 6-hour epic game and then said, okay, this really works. Now how do I turn this 1 6-hour game into 15 one-hour games? You know, and kind of add a little bit, take some stuff out here and stretch this out. But I didn't do that. I just wanted to design the system right away, and then I did it all. I did it how I did Risk Legacy, forgetting that I already started with Risk, which was kind of done, right? And I had designed like 8 games for it. So I really, and a guy I used to work with, Craig Van Ness, who was a co-designer and a lot of stuff I worked on, has made fun of me nonstop since leaving Hasbro. He's like, why did you pick this for your first thing? Like, why not do, like, 4 games, you know, and get your name out there? I was like, well, it's too late now. Now I'm in it. So I really underestimated the difficulty of putting together a giant system that's supposed to change over 15 games. My bad.
Definitely. That's a huge, I don't know. It gives me that sinking feeling in my stomach just thinking about it. So.
Me too.
Also, just for note, Seth came back in and said, hey, also, other than Francis Drake, can you make turn order each season dependent on progress or position? So whoever's behind goes first, maybe, that kind of thing. I know I use that in Viva Java. It's kind of a quick fix, but it's still... Yeah,
I would have to, and I'm playing around with the scoring system right now, so it might work. Right now there's a lot of ties. Right, it would be you'd have to go to tiebreakers.
You're only playing 8 points, right?
You're only playing 8. There's a legacy mechanism that when you first start the game, you start with 3, and if you win a game, it goes down. So there's a lot of people clumped on the victory chart, but everything's up in the air right now around that, so I will factor that in.
Yeah.
TC, how do you get around that with ties? I encounter that with Viticulture too.
Oh, with ties?
Yeah.
Well, that's. It was really easy because it's a visual component, like 3-dimensional. In Viva Java, you stack the pieces on the victory track.
Oh, okay.
Specifically, they used to be coffee cups. You know, I used to have like little coffee cups that you would stack. Mm-hmm. And the idea, you know, the person, then you know top to bottom, and you start, and that's the thing too. That's one of those things that I really like about Risk Legacy in general, is just the idea that you intro first, then you build. The idea was you start the game of Viva Java stacking those pieces initially. Like, you start with a stack of pieces. You don't, which is weird for a game, but you start with a stack of 3 pieces, so you know already, okay, this is how turn order is going to go. So you already, from the very first turn, have done the thing that causes you to remember how turn order is done. People still get it wrong, but at the same time, as long as you're consistent, you're good.
Yep.
I like that.
And stacking would work here too, right? Because you put a marker on the victory track and it moves up. So the first, you know, the next person in could stack on top, and then, you know, it could go from there. I could decide which way you break the ties, top to bottom or bottom to top.
You could always do it Risk Legacy style, where you add it on later. I mean, it might not even be the mechanic at the beginning. It could be the mechanic later on in the game.
That's true. That's true. Right now it just passes around, and I got other things. And it's, like I said, it's mostly working well, but where it's not. And I'm being particular. I don't like games where you play the math.
Yeah.
You know, I want someone at the next day to say, like, ah, I burned his city to the ground and I won. Not, I got 80 points on the raid track. You know, like, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's a personal thing of mine that I need to try to fix here. Because one of my playtests...
Well, I would say the one other thing you can take from, like, Alien Frontiers 2 is that a little bit of an area control element doesn't make people mad about winning or losing victory points. So if you're going up or down a little bit just because you did have this spot but someone else came in, now you've equalized it and you don't have that point anymore, it doesn't feel like you lost the point. You knew already that it was going to be there. So if there's something there with the islands, or you might be able to neutralize a point or two and still have that strategic...
And there's nothing special about 8 points. It's just where I am now. I could talk to you and next week I'm like, you got to get to 100 points and just change the whole scale and do that. I'm in a bit of a mess with it right now, but I've been here before and I know that it's just temporary.
Yeah. We're just throwing out ideas.
Yeah, no, I like it.
Hey guys, this hours went super fast. This has been great.
Yeah, it has.
But it's 8:56. So, do you guys, I want to give you a few minutes, Jamie and Rob, to just give us any good advice for game designers, new or people who've done it before. Jamie, we'll start with you.
Sure, yeah. A big part of the reason that Stonemaier Games exists is because of Kickstarter, so I want to connect my answer to that to Kickstarter. I would recommend to, and some people will definitely disagree with this, but this is my opinion, that if you're designing a game that you want to put on Kickstarter, as you're designing it, keep in mind that you're designing it for Kickstarter, and leave some areas open to optimize the Kickstarter experience for backers. I think Kickstarter, a great Kickstarter project, creates a memory and an experience that carries over into the game when the backers finally get it. And so I think there are things that you can do as a designer to leave open the design, so that the backers feel like they're a part of the project, and that and especially connecting with stretch goals, where you have a core game, not unlike how Risk Legacy starts out, and then you unlock new stretch goals or new elements like in Risk Legacy that make the game bigger or more complex.
What is that?
I don't know. Can you guys?
That's brand new.
Oh, here we go.
Wow, that was the weirdest thing I've ever seen on here.
I was like,
censored. Sorry, you're done.
Yeah. The NSA.
No, my camera's on my iPhone. I'm using this app that connects the camera to via Wi-Fi to the computer, and I guess I'm running low on batteries, so. Yeah. But yeah, that would be my design suggestion for designers who are thinking about going with Kickstarter.
That's great, because you hear those horror stories of the people that don't think of that, and right. The things that go wrong when they're super successful, right? I mean, there are problems caused because they're too successful and they didn't plan for that, so.
Right.
Cool. Rob, what you got?
What I have, I'm going to go more for the design side, and I always like to say that I think good game design, if you've been doing it for a while, is listening to your unconscious, but then kind of filtering it through your conscious mind, if that makes sense. I know it's going to get a little touchy-feely for a minute on that, but are we still on? Everything just went pause for a minute.
I can hear you.
Yeah,
okay.
We're good.
I got a weird screen, and everyone at the bottom wasn't moving. I find that my best ideas, you know, I play a lot of games, and I'm doing something, and all of a sudden I go, oh, a disc. This needs a disc. And I'm like, what do I mean? You're like, I'll get an idea out of nowhere. This needs like a disc that you spin, and I don't even know what my brain is talking about, but I've learned to like just write that down and then apply conscious thinking to it. Like, what do I mean by a disc? Where did that come from? And I use sort of my conscious mind. I'm like, oh, right, that solves this problem I was thinking about, because it's very easy to be listening to your conscious mind and your unconscious, like, how about a disc? And you're like, screw that. And you're like, I don't know what you're talking about, crazy other part of my brain. And it's like a really touchy-feely way to think about game design. But I think it makes a big difference.
Awesome. That's really good points. I like that as well. Great advice from you guys, and thank you again for coming on the show. I want to give you a second here. Forgot this last time. Jamie, you want to throw out your websites and your Twitter and such?
Sure. My Twitter is my name. It's Jamie Stegmaier. And our website is stonemeyergames.com. I'm not sure if that's on the screen here, but can you guys see Stonemeyer Games on the screen?
No.
I can't.
You can't. Okay, well, it's stone and then M-A-I-E-R games.com. If you search online for Euphoria or Viticulture, you should be able to find the website.
Cool. And Rob?
My Twitter handle is RobDavioGamer, which is that at the bottom of my screen?
It's not, for some reason. That's really weird.
Is my name?
We've had some issues. Your name's there, but the thing below it's not. We've had some issues lately, but that's happened to a couple people.
All right, so take my name. That's right there on the screen. Gamer at the end. If you don't put gamer, you'll get my personal account that I rarely use, and you'll be very bored. And my website is either robdavio.com, which is more of my consulting side to the mass market industry, or ironwallgames.com, which is my little self-publishing label that hasn't done much yet, but that site's going to be awesome in like 5 years.
That's great. Cool. Well, did any of the regular panelists have anything else you wanted to talk about before we went? Or
I just want to plug one thing.
Yeah. Plug away.
I got to plug Unpub 4, which is coming yes. to Delaware, Dover, Delaware, January. 17th, 18th, 19th, I think, right? The
16th, 17th, 18th.
Martin Luther King birthday weekend is. If all the tables are full for designers, so everybody's there, there's like, I think, 55 tables that are full with designers. But we need playtesters. We need people that are coming out. It's free to come. Some publishers are giving out free goodies to designers. Some of the people coming in the doors, there'll be door prizes, too, so you can win games. And you would help everybody that's playing these games. But it's an awesome experience. So.
Yes. I know at least that TC and I will both be there. So anybody else? I don't know if any other panelists are going to be there. No? Chevy might, but...
I will not.
It'll be a good time for those of you who can make it. Yeah, cool. Well, thank you for everybody who joined in. We appreciate it. Sorry if we didn't get to your question. I know there were a lot of questions, and we had a lot to talk about, and we didn't quite get to all of them. But thank you, guys. Please keep coming back every other week. You can find this on YouTube as soon as we're done. You'll be able to watch it over again if you missed it. In addition, we will post it on Tuesday on the BTG Co-op. That's btgco-op.com, and you can find it there. Thank you to everybody again. Thank you to Jamie and to Rob especially for joining us this week. And everybody have a good night. Good night.
Thanks. You too.
Good night.